Hello, welcome to this bonus episode of 10,000 Posts, a show about how everything is posting. My name is Hussein. Phoebe is away today, so it will just be me, and I am joined by our friend, lots of time comer on the show, although we haven't had him on for a minute. We are back with Ryan Broderick. Ryan is the author of Garbage Day. He was the co-host, or is the co-host, of Content Minds. I'm not sure. Are you still doing the pod? Is it still something that you want to plug?
Hello. We're on hiatus. I think that's the easiest way to put it. We both got stuff going on in our lives, but you know, the internet is forever. But thank you for bringing me on today to talk about my new appointment in the Conservative government in the UK. I'm very excited to be joining my friends David Cameron and Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Real Avengers setup.
What's your job? What's the assignment that you've been given?
So I guess this is a thing where you're from, but I will be forcibly arresting people who put out the bins wrong. From what I understand, it's a big problem in the UK. So
it is. No, genuinely. No, I think, like, this is the segue that I will pivot on. I don't check my next door very often, but the one thing I will respond to is, and one of the reasons I am leaving my current dwelling is partly because the bin men don't show up on time, but also when they do, they rearrange my bins in ways that disrupt the system. I have a systemic bin routine. There's the normal bin, there's the recycling bin, there's the plastics bin, there is the gardening bin. They all exist in a certain way, and the bin men just come and ruin it, and it does annoy me. I respect them, but I respect them a lot less when they change the order of that system. It does really ruin my day. So thank you for taking on this job, because it is really important.
Yeah, no, the bins are too woke, and I'm here to fix that. So I'm happy to do my job.
Well, thank you so much. You're also coming from Brazil, so assuming that you're on a work trip to discover how they do the bins, and so.
Oh man, don't even get me started on how Brazilians do trash collection. It's so complicated. Like, they have like three different. It's so complicated. So no, I spend part of my year in Sao Paulo, because my girlfriend lives here, so we go back and forth. That's also why you're probably going to hear environmental noise behind me, because it's over 40 degrees Celsius here, and I just cannot close the windows of the studio or I will faint. But yeah, man, to go back to the real heart of today's episode, which is how Brazilians do recycling, it's so complicated. They have like a cardboard one, and then they have one that's just for food waste, so you have to like separate your food waste. It's really confusing. And after many years, I still can't wrap my head around it.
Right. So you're actually in the place where they have the woke bins. Because there's like the system we have in South London is very far removed from that.
The bins are woke here. That's the thing. In Brazil, the SJWs make taking out the trash way too complicated. And once Bolsonaro gets out of jail or whatever, and you know, fixes this country, all right, I've gone way too off on a tangent now. But I love Lula, and the Workers' Party's great, and the bins aren't too woke for me here. So
thank you. So thank you for coming on. So I've brought you back on the show in part because I want to talk about a guy that you've written about quite a lot. But also a guy that we've mentioned on the show quite a lot. One Mr. Beast, Monsieur Beast. I don't know what other phrases you could use to call him is. He has been doing some colonialism, I guess, depending on who you're reading. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a very Ryan Broderick question, which is, have you seen the new Garfield trailer? And what do you think of it?
I have. And I actually thought it was an edit. I thought it was fake at first, because I was like, oh, that's funny. Like, they put Chris Pratt in it. Like, that's funny that like somebody would do that. And then I realized that, no, that is it. That Chris Pratt is also Garfield now. Chris Pratt's ongoing war of terror against Italian American culture has not stopped with Mario. And now he's going after the most famous lasagna eater of all, Garfield. very interesting to me that's his next step. I don't think that movie looks good, but you know what? If it can get Gen Alpha off their iPads and back into the newspaper reading Garfield every day, that's all that matters to me, you know?
Like, because I was going to ask, because like Garfield probably like has more relevance, cultural relevance to you, not least because like I'm at a stage where I completely forgot that Garfield was a comic, and one that you would read in the newspaper. also, every time I think about Garfield, I think about the creator who had, I mean, no, Dilbert, the guy who invented Dilbert, he has the Dilbert Castle. I thought that there was a Garfield Castle as well, but apparently that was fake. So the creator of Garfield's the normal one, right?
Well, sort of. I mean, he's got like a Garfield factory where like Garfield stuff is just produced in mass, you know, forever. But I have time for Garfield. You know, obviously the internet makes it hard to genuinely embrace things like Garfield, because, you know, now when you think of Garfield, you think about how sexy and muscular he is. But the original
pregnant Garfield,
or how pregnant he is. But the original Garfield comic is pretty good. And, you know, when I was a kid, I really enjoyed that cat wanting to eat too much food. You know, that's pretty funny to me.
It was very, very relatable.
That was my Roblox, you know. I really appreciated it.
Well, yeah, I watched the trailer very briefly before we started recording, and all I can say is, if we can get the young people to get away from Andrew Tate and to like take inspiration from Garfield, I support that. And if that means we have to have Chris Pratt doing that, then maybe it's a sacrifice worth making. I don't know. I don't want to like be too embedded with any opinions. You know, just in case they come and bite me in the ass.
I agree. You never know when Garfield's going to get canceled. So. Or Chris Pratt, to be honest. I mean, he's been jonesing for a cancellation for a while, you know.
Maybe that's what he's trying to do. Like, it's the sort of classic, I'm doing all these sort of like bizarre Italian American caricatures. Please cancel me. Please just let me be free. But because he's not quite going there, because he's not quite doing the thing that would get him canceled, he's sort of on the brim, and so he's just having to take up all these very strange projects. Well, so I'm looking forward to him being.
Wait, hold on. I have like a real big galaxy brain thought, but I think this actually connects to Mr. Beast, which is for many years, people have tried to cancel Chris Pratt because he sucks and he can't be canceled because he's like a super religious, like, you know, weirdo who doesn't seem to have many skeletons in his closet. So most people on the internet have just given up trying to cancel him. And now we're just like, no, we don't like you. And there's no real reason. We just don't like you, which to me is very similar, I think, to how the internet is slowly turning against Mr. Beast, which is they want to cancel him. And obviously he's like a dum-dum. You know, he's not like a particularly smart or nuanced individual, but, you know, you can't totally cancel him for what he's doing. So I think at the end of the day, you just gotta be like, this guy sucks ass and like, I don't like him. And you know what? I think that's better. I think that's like a better way to do it. I think instead of trying to get the moral superiority, you can just go low right out the gate and be like, this guy sucks ass. I don't like his Garfield.
Well, that's just,
you know, there you go.
Well, that's just like kind of classic internet stuff, right? Like there was a time where it was like, nope, just don't like you. Like you suck. That's it. Like they didn't have to be a reason. And like, you know, now where you sort of have, where there is this pressure to be like, no, if you don't like me, I need you to explain to me exactly why you don't like me. And it needs to be nuanced and it needs to sort of, I need to be able to engage with those arguments and respond to them. And so maybe you're right. Maybe this just is very much the case of like, yeah, we just think he sucks and that's it.
Yeah.
But I will take your segue offer. I will take your segue offer of the Mr. Beast thing to get into the current situation with Mr. Beast. You wrote about this in your newsletter fairly recently. Someone sent this to me with the intention of like, hey, when are you going to do the Mr. Beast video that you keep talking about, or the Mr. Beast episode you keep talking about? Well, today is it, hopefully. This video is called I Built 100 Wells in Africa. Mr. Beast goes to Kenya and he brings a team, or he uses a team to dig a bunch of wells, and it made a bunch of people really mad. But it also made a bunch of people really happy because they're mad at the Kenyan government. So as someone who has been paying more attention to Mr. Beast, let me ask you this as the opener. Can you please explain to me what is happening in this video and like how this fits into the sort of broader Mr. Beast ecosystem online?
Sure. Mr. Beast's entire project is based around essentially like a very simple math equation that he figured out about 7 years ago, let's say. And the math equation goes like this. If Mr. Beast spends X amount of money in a video, that video will produce Y amount of traffic, which will then equate to Z amount of ad revenue. And he's been able to sort of plug in these numbers in increasingly large amounts. And he talks very openly about this, where he says, you know, like all of his money goes back into his videos. And unlike, let's say, a typical Hollywood production, where that money is going to go into like better production values or like better writing if we were back in the 90s or like bigger stars, Mr. Beast's whole thing is giving out or spending more money on camera. There's no artifice. There's no detachment there. So, you know, he first starts out, you know, in the 2010s, giving literally just going out into the street and giving homeless people money. His first big videos where he would go out with like $1,000 to $10,000 and just give them to random homeless people and film it. And then that would, you know, go viral. And now he's just doing it on a scale that the internet has never seen. We've never seen a creator operate at this level before, where they're spending millions and sometimes multi-million dollar budgets on their videos. We've never seen that. Even PewDiePie, when he was at this level of viral output, was not spending millions of dollars on like new cat ear gamer headsets or whatever. He was just sitting there playing video games. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Beast isn't like that. He's spending this money. And so when he does his philanthropy, people get really uncomfortable because it's impossible to separate that from his other videos where he's like on a super yacht or crashing a train into a pit. Those are things he does often, you know? And so that's my general take on his whole deal.
So I haven't really watched, I didn't really watch Mr. Beast videos, but what I have sort of noticed is like the takeover of Mr. Beast content. The Kenya video feels different though. And this is, and partly it's because it falls under the sort of Mr. Beast, Mr. Beast philanthropy. And so as I'm sort of looking into this more, it seems like Mr. Beast isn't just a YouTuber. He's sort of developed a bunch of sort of offshoots, which include ghost kitchens, which include like a snack division, or whatever you want to call that. But this falls into Mr. Beast philanthropy. And you note in your newsletter, and you've also noted elsewhere, that like this is a very sort of conscious move that Mr. Beast is trying to make, and one that he gets annoyed that he doesn't get enough credit for. I guess like the second question then is like, well, what is Mr. Beast philanthropy? Because I guess like there are sort of, you know, there are actually like two videos. There's one where he builds 100 wells. There's another where they sort of produce, where they sort of supply electricity to a village, to a remote village in Kenya. Everyone, like people who sort of may not know Mr. Beast will probably remember one of the early philanthropic projects of like taking plastic out of the oceans. Where does this fit into sort of the broader, you know, like Beast strategy, if you sort of want to call it that? Because this feels different to like what other YouTubers are doing. And I wonder like whether it sort of tells us something about what Mr. Beast actually wants to achieve or what he wants to do.
Well, I think, okay, so the first important thing to note is that like Beast Philanthropy, the page, is run by a real nonprofit called Mr. Charity.
Right. Okay. Yep. Okay. Fine. All right. Right.
And he's such an interesting figure to talk about because I don't think he's nefarious. I think he's dumb. I think he's a dumb guy, or at least he's not very like aware of the world. And so from his standpoint, like, I think it makes a lot of sense where it's like, oh, I have all this money coming in. I can make a nonprofit. You know, it's a really good financial model, spending a lot of money on a charity. Like, that's a great tax write-off for him. And it goes viral. He can use the same, it seems like he's using all the same editing tricks and the same production sort of pipeline to create these videos. I think for him, it's a no-brainer. It's like, oh, we're making tons of money. People like this content. I can just keep making this content. And he approaches it with like a very like born yesterday attitude where it's like, what's the deal with like water in Africa? Let me go fix it. You know, like that's his thing. And his audience loves that because his audience, I hesitate to like, and I've seen people do this. I've seen people like argue that there's a political slant to his videos or his audience, but I don't really think that's true. I think it's more just that he has a very young, overwhelmingly male audience who idolize him and sort of aspire to be like him. And so when he makes these videos, it's very much the same impulse that you see around like the fandom with Elon Musk. Whereas people being like, you know, I want to be the Elon Musk of my own life. I want to be the Mr. Beast of my own life. I want to have like a chocolate brand and do charity work and, you know, goof around with my friends on a super yacht. So I think from his point of view, this all makes total sense. It's like, yeah, why wouldn't we do it? And then when it goes out into the world and people are, in my opinion, rightfully grossed out by it, he has a little meltdown every time. And now he's like preemptively having the meltdowns, where with this last one, he was tweeting about how people weren't going to like it before it even went out. So clearly it's bothering him. Like, this is really like obviously something that's making him upset, which is interesting to me that he hasn't like been able to look inward enough to figure out why.
I was like quite interested. I was trying to read some like, or see if there's any local press around the sort of how Mr. Beast sort of got to the situation of like building wells and supply, being sort of like a resource supplier to these villages in Kenya. And there seems to sort of be like this divide between certain people who are kind of unequivocally pro Mr. Beast, whatever he does. And you know, I'm sort of interested in like what that demographic looks like. There's another sort of set of demographic who are like, yeah, Mr. Beast is kind of interesting, but like these claims that he's being canceled for providing water, which is his words, like he was being canceled for providing water to like poor Kenyans. You know, seeing that as kind of like a very, like as a ridiculous statement, which I think speaks to what you were talking about in terms of his need and desire for attention. There's the third demographic who I wouldn't necessarily say are Mr. Beast fans, but who are kind of people who, you know, in a lot of cases seemingly like Kenyans who have access to the internet, so like in places like Mombasa and stuff, where they've sort of said, well, you know, actually this might not be a, you know, people are sort of criticizing him for being a savior, but like, or being a white, like a typical white savior type of guy, but the kind of local governments aren't providing these types of, you know, like energy resources or infrastructure that he's doing. And so if we have, and to me, like, I haven't read too much about that to sort of like test the veracity of those claims, but it does sort of point to something quite much broadly interesting, which is whether Mr. Beast kind of see like what he sees himself as outside of YouTube. So in your piece, you kind of say that one of the crises that Mr. Beast is facing right now, and this may be the case for other YouTubers as well, is that as they become older, how do they sort of stay relevant online? You know, so we see some like creators, some YouTubers sort of like moving into producing products, some that kind of like make their own companies and sort of phase out of YouTube, some who are like kind of pivoting to other platforms. Mr. Beast is in a different situation because I think for him, and I think the last time I spoke about him on this show, we were really talking about how he was trying to build YouTube and other platforms into his own image and sort of leveraging his, leveraging his success online to sort of try and make platforms work to benefit him. But his success is very much dependent on virality, as you know, and very much dependent on algorithms kind of providing him that virality, which is to say that like it could change at any point. And I wondered whether you could talk to me about how the Mr. Beast ecosystem actually works. Because I think at a basic level, one of the things I'm just often quite confused about is like, well, how is he making the money to do this stuff? Like, how is he kind of making the money to like not only do these types of big projects, but these ones that sort of guarantee, but the ones that are sort of built in such exorbitant ways that it sort of guarantees a type of virality, which is necessary for him to exist on these platforms. I don't know if that makes any sense. Or
it does. No. So I get what you're saying. And he's banked so many videos over a million now that like he's not just making a lot of money off the newest video. He's making insane amounts of money off the backlog that will just play forever. And he has not encountered an optimization trick that he hasn't used. You know, like his videos are all extremely consistent. You can press play on his channel and let it go for hours and it will just feel like the same quality, which is like a major thing there. He also really understands his audience, and more than that, he understands YouTube, which I think is now beginning to affect his ability to be taken seriously beyond YouTube, which is really my read on a lot of this charity stuff, which is not only is it like a great tax write-off and makes him feel good, I think that it's him trying to, in this like very Gen Z, like internet brain way, try to like feel around in the dark to figure out how to be taken seriously. And he's done interviews about how he gets upset that people think he's gaming YouTube, and that he'll defend himself and say, oh, I'm not gaming YouTube. I just know that YouTube has a set of rules. And if you follow them perfectly and spend thousands of man hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars perfecting them, you will go viral. And he talks about it all of the time. But he doesn't seem to understand that that is gaming YouTube. My theory is because he started so early on YouTube that to him, there's nothing grotesque or lame about doing that. Whereas, you know, for people our age, we look at that and we're like, ugh, like, what are you doing? But for him and for people who watch him, he's just playing the game the way it's meant to be played. And it's actually quite inspirational for his viewers. And I think up until recently, he was very comfortable with that. And now, if you listen to him in certain, you know, podcast appearances, he seems bitter. He seems more bitter now than he did, let's say, 3 years ago. And I sort of sympathize with him, because like if you were under the age of 30 and you only knew YouTube and you became the king of YouTube, and then you suddenly started to like age out of that and realize that no one around you takes what you're doing seriously beyond just like, oh, look at all this money you're making. Yeah, I think I would probably be bitter about it too.
Maybe. I mean, like, I suppose I think about it. I'm thinking about this in when I thought about other YouTubers that I've sort of phased out and have had to sort of accept that like they're too old, or like that they may not kind of be like, to be like the king of the platform may be like an untenable position to be in. You know, where, you know, as I mentioned, like, you know, some of them sort of have to kind of figure out what the commercial opportunities, like how they sort of pivot their commercial opportunities, whether like they need to sort of change their types of content. I think with Mr. Beast, what seems to be quite interesting, like, so I don't know if this is a good analogy, but I think about like Emma Chamberlain, for example, right? Who I think has sort of reached that sort of stage of becoming too famous to be like a relatable YouTuber, but has kind of been able to navigate through different like adjacent worlds that her content was in to basically build a career out where she isn't so defined by YouTube. But Mr. Beast seems to be defined by YouTube, in part because, like, as you mentioned, like he was very much the self-proclaimed king of YouTube, like the one who sort of cracked it better than any, like, you know, of the other YouTubers like who came kind of before him. And so what happens when you are only the king, when you sort of are defined as being the king of that type of platform? I think, again, you point at this in your newsletter as well, where you sort of say that, like, you know, for lots of sort of legacy media brands, TV, like TV production companies, movie production companies, like they don't really see a place for him. And I wonder whether that's kind of like, you know, well, actually, I guess one of the questions that's worth asking is like, were there any other YouTubers like him or who found themselves in that position and were able to kind of like pivot out of it better than he's been able to? Like the only example I can think of at the top of my head might be like Jake Paul, who sort of goes from a YouTuber career to this kind of weird sort of, you know, he is tentatively now kind of, I think in some circles seen much more as like an athlete than he was a YouTuber. And so, and in that way, maybe it's successful. I just don't see Mr. Beast being able to do that because so much of his identity is kind of driven by the need to be successful on not just any platform, but this specific kind of platform.
The question about whether or not anyone has sort of run up into this before is really interesting. And I'm trying to think. So we've definitely had influencers and creators that have crossed over to some success, you know, whether it's members of the Try Guys showing up on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, or Tyler Oakley had like a short-lived sort of role on like red carpets. I feel like Zoella in the UK like almost did it. Like she got pretty close. Like there have been Jake Paul to a degree, but I feel like most people kind of write him off still, even though he is like technically the owner, I think, of like the most popular energy drink in the world right now. You know, don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure his drink is very popular. So like there are lots of these people, but most of them make a decision somewhere around the point where Mr. Beast was about 2 years ago, where they say like, okay, do I want to do this forever? Can I do this forever? Or is it time to start pivoting to more mainstream, more establishment types of fame? And Mr. Beast, is new in the sense that he realized that he was making enough money that instead of going to something like Netflix and asking to work with them, he could just, and this is what he did. He spent millions of his own money to just do his own Squid Game. And we've never seen a creator be able to reach that level before. In my mind, I cannot think of one creator that was able to come up to that choice and decide, well, I can use my own funds to do that. Which makes him interesting to me. But I do think that all he really did was kind of put a pause on making that decision, because ultimately you're just going to run out of stuff to do on the internet, especially when you're producing that much content. And so I think he's sort of found himself stuck in the exact position he was before Squid Game. And now, you know, he's even more tied together in people's minds with YouTube.
Mm. You noted in your newsletter that one of the demographics that Mr. Beast is kind of like markets his content to finds the charity stuff that he does a bit weird. I don't know if it's just that demographic, but you sort of noted how like part of the reason why the reaction to this is so strange is because the videos themselves feel so strange. And I wondered like whether you could talk to me a little bit about that, like what makes these types of videos so weird compared to, I don't know, like your sort of other classic Mr. Beast videos.
Yeah. So it's, hold on one second.
No worries.
Yeah. So it's, I think it comes down to the look and the feel of them, where they're, you know, there's no visual or aesthetic difference between what he's doing for charity and what he's doing for money or for entertainment, because he doesn't care enough to make that distinction. And it's really funny because like he's obviously not the first game show host, which is essentially what he is. He's not the first game show host to kind of try to make what they're doing more philanthropic. And this goes all the way back to like the very first quiz shows on TV, but he's so obsessed with the aesthetic requirements of virality on YouTube that he can't understand how ugly and off-putting it is to like to like film a game show where you're making people who couldn't see be able to see again. You know, like in his LASIK surgery video, he had a counter at the bottom of the screen that was counting the number of blind people cured in his like disgusting like in his disgusting Comic Sans font thing. So like he doesn't really see it. He doesn't seem to get it. It's sort of mind blowing actually at this point that he still can't wrap his head around why the entire concept of the very special episode exists. Yeah. I almost want to like sit him down and be like, okay, we're going to talk through the first 80 years of mass media history so you can understand why everyone hates you. Like that's all it is, I think.
I sort of sometimes wonder whether what we're actually seeing is like an overstretching, because and this is sort of where I get confused, because like he's a really popular creator, right? Like I see lots of like children and young people like wearing his merchandise. I have seen kind of children cry when they don't get Feastables in the store. I have seen like videos of that type. It's like, you know, he by all measures is this.
Do you cry when you can't get your Feastables?
I did. I cried to my wife when she wouldn't buy me Feastables.
Yeah, when your wife's boyfriend wouldn't get you Mr. Beast Feastables. Yeah, I get it.
Well, you know, actually, he said that I do have a surprise this Christmas. So
is it a new goon shed? They're going to take you out to the goon shed and feed you Mr. Beast chocolate?
Oh my God. This has been the first and only time we have mentioned the word goon on this show. I'm putting a stop to it right now. Oh my God. Okay. Back to my very serious interviewer question.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
He's like a popular creator. Right. And so what I'm really struggling with, or like what I'd love for you to like sort of elaborate on more, is that when you sort of say, no, he's hated, like, what does that kind of mean? Cause like, to me, it's like, okay, well, like, you've got a good thing going in the sense that, you know, cause okay. So like the thing about old YouTubers, so much of what I understand old YouTubers to be is that their audience are sort of generally like the same age as them, maybe slightly younger, but they're sort of like the premium was sort of in relatable content of some form or aspirational content of some form. And so as they grow older, and like, you know, I think Zoella is like a good good example of this. As they grow older and those choices become like more minimal, as they kind of reckon with the idea of aging and having children and sort of like, you know, using the benefits of their YouTube channel to kind of achieve a type of material success that a lot of their, you know, audience of similar people to them were not able to attain. You know, that's kind of where the model suddenly sort of breaks apart. Like when these YouTubers become so famous that they can no longer sort of feign the idea of relatability, that's when you sort of have the crisis. But Mr. Beast isn't really like that. Like from what I've seen of his content, he is not really trying to reach people who are in their sort of 30s. I think he's like something in his 30s or like late 20s at least. A lot of his content seems to be designed for children. He seems to sort of, one way to understand him is to sort of be a children's entertainer, or at least like a teenager's entertainer. So he's got a good thing going. I don't understand like why, like what is your sort of thinking behind him feeling that he is unpopular or feeling as if he is not kind of achieving what he deserve, what he feels he deserves to achieve.
I just made it up. I just thought it'd be fun to spread some misinformation on the internet. No. So, okay, a couple of things. One, I was talking to a member of Generation Z the other day, and they asked me a really funny question where we were talking about YouTubers, and they asked me, you know, what was the first YouTuber that I really liked? And I was like, oh, like there weren't any, because when YouTuber became a concept, I was working my first job out of college. And for most of the 2010s, the people who were famous online were either like boy band or girl band equivalent. They were young people making content for young people, or they were children's entertainers. They were either those people who continued to make content and now were suddenly in their 30s making the same content for children, or they were people who came in to make content for children. And it wasn't really until the pandemic, in my opinion, that YouTube matured in a way where suddenly I knew almost every millennial I know has a bunch of favorite YouTube channels they watch, myself included. But that shift took about a decade. And even still, like I watch YouTube every day now. I'm not watching Mr. Beast because Mr. Beast, as you said, is making content directed at younger viewers based on his editing style, his subject matter, the depth of the videos, the speed, like all of that is obviously tailored towards younger people. The reason why I think this is beginning to bother him is one, he is now 25 years old. And so no matter how pudding brained he is, you cannot make content like that for the better part of a decade and not just reach a point where it's going to be boring to you, unless you're like a complete sociopath. I listen to him on podcasts a lot. That's actually the major way that I kind of interact with his content. And he more and more will just go on some like really weird rant about what people think about him. And it's like every time I listen to him, he has some rambling thing where he starts talking about how people don't take him seriously or how people think that he's like not authentic or yada, yada, yada. And then his Twitter is also his X account. I'm sorry. His X account is also full of the same kind of stuff more and more where, you know, if you look at what he was doing on the platform 2 years ago, it was just like, hey, I'm Mr. Beast, like eat my chocolate. Like, you know, I'm going to put you in like a box for 5 days and give you $1 million. Now it's like the woke left won't let me give water to Africans. You know, it's like, it's nonsense. And so from where I'm standing, it seems to be weighing on him. And as much as I dunk on him, I should say, I don't think he is a bad or nefarious person. My most charitable read on his whole deal is that he is in some capacity in the back of his head aware that he is reaching the line. He's reaching the wall. And I think he's a little freaked out that even in his, you know, millions and millions of dollars, he doesn't have a show on Max or Netflix or Disney Plus. He hasn't been embraced by the mainstream yet, and he's at the top. Like, how freaky must that be to be like, oh, I'm the biggest YouTuber that's ever existed, and Hollywood wants seemingly nothing to do with me.
I wonder whether it's also because I think, as you mentioned, he's sort of reaching the brink of like what he can really do that's sort of innovative or new. And you know, there's lots of cases of YouTubers who just don't really care about that. But seemingly like if the appeal of his videos is kind of always sort of raising the stakes, well, at a certain point, like you know, bar, and you know, and again, it makes me think about, okay, well, if we think about like Mr. Charity content, the philanthropy content, I wonder where that kind of blends into this anxiety over like pushing the boundaries. And so, you know, in his case, it's like, well, we can't, if Squid Games was sort of this pinnacle of like Mr. Beast content of a particular year, and now that's something that's so faded that like even the Netflix version of the Mr. Beast version of Squid Games is not really as kind of appealing as it was pitched to be, then the next sort of stage is very much like, well, it really comes down to infrastructure, right? And this is where I sort of thought these videos were really interesting, because like one somewhat cynical but maybe kind of overly strategic reason that I'm giving him too much credit for is really this idea that really, you know, when I was talking to Taylor Lorenz like not that long ago, she made this point that Mr. Beast kind of feels or like wants to sort of seem to be like the Gen Z's Elon Musk, right? Like he wants to, and I don't know what that means. I don't know whether you have any thoughts about what that sort of constitutes, but he kind of really ideally, you know, he idealizes Elon Musk, and I think just this broader idea of having his fingers in like lots of different pies and sort of being this all-round creator, kind of wanting to have everything at once, maybe sort of speaks to that. And so if he's now kind of doing infrastructure projects and he's going to countries where, you know, from what I've read from like Kenyan local press, the villages that he's chosen are ones where like the local government were sort of kind of fine with him kind of coming in and doing whatever. So from what I've read, and this is from Citizen Journal, which is an online publication based in Mombasa, like the UMT, which is sort of one of the infrastructure boards in rural parts of Kenya, worked with Mr. Beast to basically provide him the space and the resources and the team to build these wells on the basis that like, well, this is a cheaper way of providing these resources than compared to like trying to lobby the local government to then give us the funding, which may or may not come, and where people have sort of like lost faith in us to be able to do anything anyway. I wondered in that case, like, okay, well, is he seeing this as a new opportunity, right? Like a way of making content, a way of doing something that is different from other people because he has the resources to do it, but also a way of extending influence in a very different way to other YouTubers. I don't know whether I'm giving him too much credit for that, but then the sort of secondary question I had was like, well, is this kind of, how much of this is also reflective of the way that YouTube and platforms have changed? You know, as you mentioned, like the pandemic, I think really changed like the destiny of a lot of these platforms. But, you know, as the internet kind of becomes filled with content to sort of stay at the top, you do need to kind of keep on producing more and more stuff that either kind of provides like more comfortable layers of parasociality, something that Mr. Beast doesn't seem to be really capable of doing, or to just be able to do the stuff that no one else is able to do. And if that means like taking over villages or kind of running fiefdoms, I don't know, like I had this very funny idea that like he was going to, I had this idea that he was going to like try do Kony 2012 and like,
yeah,
you know, raise a militia, like
become
and
a
I
warlord,
wouldn't put that
yeah.
past, if there was one guy who would become a warlord, it would probably be Mr. Beast, right? And so,
well, the name is perfect. Yeah,
that's right. The white man known as the Beast, like you know, embedded in mythology. No, I think there might be a thing about, you know, is he really responding to just the ways in which platforms have changed, and something that no amount of like algorithmic testing is really going to be able to sort of keep him comfortably on top.
Okay, so there's a lot there. First, I'll talk about the Elon Musk comparison, because I think it might actually, in a roundabout way, answer all the other ones, which is, I don't see Mr. Beast. I like Taylor a lot. I'm not causing drama by disagreeing with her, but I will slightly push against it and say that Elon Musk and Mr. Beast, I think, are part of the same large-scale generational trend where being a famous actor or starting a band with your friends 20 years ago, which was sort of what everyone aspired to, the story you would get kind of swept up in, or starting a podcast, I guess, that is now sort of morphed into this idea of, oh, wouldn't it be great if me and my friends could start a brand, and that brand could be chocolate, and it could be YouTube videos, and we could do charity stuff, and we could go viral, and we could do all this cool stuff, and we could run this company together. And I think Elon Musk scratches that for certain people, and Mr. Beast scratches that for certain people. And I think that existed before either of them. Like the beginnings of that were already sort of around, and those two are just riding the wave really well right now. And so if you think about like what Mr. Beast is beyond just like a guy who goes viral on YouTube, what he really is selling and what he's, you know, really monetizing is this aspirational story of Mr. Beast is going to be the biggest ever of anything. And YouTube is a really great platform for doing that on, because part of being a creator is getting people on board with your story and them following your success and feeling like every view they give you is helping you achieve your destiny of being the biggest ever. And Mr. Beast knows that. I mean, there's no way he doesn't know that, because every creator kind of knows that. The charity stuff to me is, I think it largely has to do with sort of making that stuff feel more important. I really kind of come back to this idea that like late stage Mr. Beast, where he is right now, is about trying to find a way to make all of this matter and make all of this make sense, because he's been at it for so long. And I think part of him legitimately thought that he would have surpassed YouTube at some point. And he hasn't. And I've seen him in interviews say that he never wants to, and that he'll always do YouTube. And if he works with any streamer or any TV station or movie studio, he'd always keep doing YouTube. But I don't buy it. I just don't. I think he is sort of at a moment. I think he's found himself at a moment. I keep talking over myself, but he's such an astute study of other YouTubers that there's no way he doesn't realize that he's running into the same wall. Like, all of his early videos were about him reverse engineering what made PewDiePie popular and YouTubers like him. So there's no way in my mind that he doesn't also understand that, like, you hit 25 on YouTube with an audience like that, like, it's going to start getting to the it starts becoming an uphill battle. As you said, the relatability is draining.
Yeah. And I suppose, I mean, so that could sort of like bring us on to not necessarily Mr. Beast, but I think like there are sort of, you know, and I wondered whether you could talk about your observations about how platforms have changed over like, you know, the past few years that make kind of the stuff that Mr. Beast do like more difficult. Cause I do also think that like when it comes to sort of doing, you know, this isn't the case of just like younger YouTubers or younger video creators who are like are on TikTok being able to sort of replace older ones. It does sort of feel like as you have these platforms much more embedded into popular culture, the ways that, you know, societies function, the idea of like even sort of making a living on YouTube or making a living doing like video content seems to be a lot more difficult. But also, so while you have like a greater degree of accessibility, it can kind of feel like your time in the sun feels more and more short-lived. And so like if Mr. Beast is kind of anxious that like the whole infrastructure that he's built is kind of now becoming a lot more difficult to function because of these types of material changes, I wonder whether that actually speaks more to the ways in which platforms have changed, what they sort of incentivize, what actually works and what doesn't. So like off the top of my head, I'm thinking about like, you know, video podcasting, for example, as being one of those mediums where it is much easier to produce like long form video content. And you know, much cheaper to do so as well. Like I wonder whether you had any thoughts on whether this type of content flooding the ecosystem actually undermines the stuff that Mr. Beast does, because like to give him a little bit of credit, you know, he seems to sort of be one of the only creators who is actually like making something. I'm not saying that something is good. I'm like, you know, for me, very far from it. I don't want to talk about other people's tastes, but it does sort of feel like the amount of resources and the amount of effort you can put into one of those videos to sort of get, you know, you'll get like a few million views, but in an age where, you know, those types of like high number views become less valuable, I do wonder whether one of the issues that Mr. Beast faces is just that like the numbers that he gets is not really enough to sort of be sustainable in the way that perhaps it was used to, you know, in the 2010s.
It's very possible. I mean, so he is still the fastest growing account month to month on YouTube. He pretty much has been all year. That said, like if you go to his channel and you look through the last couple of years worth of his videos, it's pretty clear that he peaked with Squid Game a year ago, which was about a year ago. And it has 500 million views. He has not reached that number since. And he had a pretty decent back half of last year. But in the last 5 months or so, he does appear to be slowly dipping. Mm. Now, it could be that he's oversaturated himself. It could also be that maybe his bizarre A-B testing around whether or not he should smile on thumbnails. I don't know if you heard about this, but maybe it was wrong. He didn't used to smile and now he smiles. It could also be kind of what you're alluding to, which is that YouTube is quickly becoming a place where his audience isn't. That said, he's on TikTok, he's on Instagram, he's on every platform. But also, as you mentioned, those platforms don't really allow long form content the way he makes it. I mean, his videos are usually between 8 and 17 minutes long, and they're filmed like a TV show, a very bad TV show, but they're filmed like one. But in the last 4 months, I want to make sure I get this right. Yeah, in the last 4 months, he's put out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Let's say a dozen videos in the last 4 months, and none of them have cracked 200,000 views. So I am wondering if he has not sort of reached the limitations of both his own popularity and also maybe YouTube itself. I don't know.
I think that's like really, because I think like this sort of idea of just the unknown, I don't know whether that also sort of plays a big role in how we sort of understand platforms and how they work now. If only because like it does sort of feel like one of the sort of, you know, one of the sort of myth making elements of that underpins Mr. Beast is the sort of story that he spent, like, from what I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, like he dropped out of school to sort of study YouTube full time. And like his time in the sort of like, you know, in the dojo of YouTube study sort of meant that he was able to wield the blade, like to butcher analogy, better than everyone else. So within the premise of that idea being that, no, you can learn how to master these systems by like being dedicated and by grinding and just like really just by posting a lot and posting in like a very strategic way. But if we've sort of now reached a point where like that ecosystem doesn't really exist, or it's kind of doesn't function in the way that he's used to, then even the types of content that emerge out of that understanding of an ecosystem fundamentally change. So I guess another question I had was like, well, like thinking about TikTok and the sort of, you know, ubiquity of TikTok in popular culture and the fact that that's happened so rapidly, how has that affected, if it has affected, like how has it affected Mr. Beast, but how has it affected other YouTubers who kind of also had sizable audiences? Like do they see TikTok as a threat? Do they see it as like an accompaniment to the stuff that they're doing? Is there an optimism about it?
I sort of assume Mr. Beast is the last creator like this. If TikTok continues its process of redefining the way the internet works, and it is happening right now, more and more apps operate like TikTok than don't, I assume that will render the Mr. Beast type of creator extinct. The idea of this mass appeal, nicheless creator that only goes after just like the most mainstream mass appeal content imaginable, that's not something that does very well on TikTok. I mean, it does well. Hold on, let me rephrase, because that's a little complicated. Like, you can get a lot of views doing Mr. Beast content on TikTok, but your growth won't be as sort of targeted and sort of as prioritized on an app like TikTok, because TikTok is looking for what you care about. It's not really looking for, you know, bright and shiny sounds that babies can look at it on an iPad. It's looking for like what you care about, so we can laser target you that, so then it can serve you ads. And more apps function like that. Reels functions like that. YouTube actually has evolved to work like that. Even though Mr. Beast is sitting at the top of it, for the majority of people on YouTube, they're probably almost never encountering a Mr. Beast video, because they're just watching whatever their like random pocket is. And the internet has moved in that direction. You know, when you and I met a decade ago, it was about like finding like the right viral story about a sad lion and becoming the most read person on human earth, the most read person on planet Earth. But that doesn't work like that anymore. The sort of like massive publicly popular platform is going away. And I think Mr. Beast is the last man standing doing this kind of work at this level.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting way to put it. And I guess, because I want to go back to something that you said in your article, just as we sort of like close out this episode, which is that this kind of dependent on virality and the idea that like, he is sort of dependent on a very particular kind of virality. But I think the sort of more interesting question in that is how we think of virality now, because I think when we met and we worked together, like, you know, the idea of going viral certainly meant much smaller numbers, but it also meant, like, you know, the ways in which you'd understand that in terms of a trajectory would be different. The ways in which, like, something would be considered to be viral would also be much more heavily dependent on how it was engaged with. And, you know, I, from where I stand now, like, that understanding of virality doesn't really exist so much. But I've struggled to really think about, well, what does it mean to sort of go viral right now? On this show, we've sort of spoken about this mostly in terms of becoming the main character. The idea that, like, you know, not that long ago, but also seemingly quite long ago, like, to be the main character, you would basically do, you know, you would fuck up for the most part, and you would sort of be that main character for at least a week. You'd get interviewed if, like, you really, really fucked up. Then it went from, like, you know, to a couple of days, and it went to a day. And now, like, you know, now I don't even know who the main characters are, if they really exist. There's certainly no, like, you know, sad lion that everyone starts caring about. And so I think, you know, I wondered whether you could talk about, well, what kind of virality does Mr. Beast sort of rely on? And is part of this whole crisis just that, you know, really a crisis of virality, the idea that we don't really know, or, like, there is confusion over what can really be considered popular, what can be considered to be, like, longstanding? Because I think, again, that also goes back to one of the things you say in both the piece and something that you said a couple of times on this episode, which is, Mr. Beast might have the numbers. He might have numbers that eclipse so many other creators on the platform, but he has not seemingly convinced the infrastructure that YouTubers depend on to sort of continue their entertainment career that he is worth taking a punt on. Like, no one is giving him the Mr. Beast show. No one is sort of willing to sort of support his endeavors. He is very much his own self-contained element. And I do wonder whether that's kind of because there's a broader sort of cultural misunderstanding of what is considered to be viral and what is not considered to be viral.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, actually, which is, so, you know, 10, 15 years ago, stuff started to go viral and it was newsworthy when it would. It would be like, whoa, like, the most watched YouTube video ever, the most shared thing on Facebook. That's crazy. This dress, what color is it? You know? And around 2015, 2016, we kind of flipped over and there was suddenly more viral stuff than there was time in our lives to process it. And it started to feel like there was just too much of it. And a lot of the platforms that were managing all of this viral static became a lot less relevant, Facebook being the number one, right? And a new wave of apps and a new wave of features rose up around 2016, 2017 to manage this, TikTok being the most popular. TikTok treats mega viral content the way a radio station would treat songs, right? So it's going to show everybody, like, a bunch of viral videos in between your personal DJ telling you stuff that you care about and then some ads. And slowly, other apps have started to do the same. So on Twitter or X right now, you open up the For You tab, it's full of viral garbage that you're going to glaze over. And then, like, some stuff you genuinely care about, Reels, same deal. Mr. Beast came of age during this shift and was heavily influenced by the end of that era, the end of the viral era. So he is still, he's one of the last people that you're going to see headlines being like, this was the most watched YouTube video in 24 hours. Like, you just don't see people talk about that stuff anymore because it doesn't matter. Who cares? It doesn't mean anything. And no one has replaced him either. No one has sort of taken the mantle of, like, this is the most viral guy. Time to talk about it. And what's even crazier is Mr. Beast is a lot less viral than he was 6 months ago, 12 months ago. So yeah. I think the whole way of thinking about virality has shifted under our feet without us even realizing it. And now, you know, you can open up Instagram Reels and watch videos that have over 10 million views nonstop for days and have never heard of any of them, don't know who made them, don't know where they came from, and they don't matter. But 10 years ago, if a video, the Ellen DeGeneres Oscars selfie was the most liked tweet of all time, I don't even know what it is anymore. I don't know what the most liked tweet is anymore. I don't care. Who cares? It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. And Mr. Beast is the last guy that we're still thinking about that way, which is funny that he's, it's funny that it's still happening, but I don't think it's going to be happening for much more much longer.
Yeah. Well, just because we're sort of coming up this time, I wanted to ask you one more question, which actually relates to that, which is, well, where do you kind of, like, do you have any thoughts on, like, where, like, what, like, if maybe one way of putting it is, like, what replaces virality? If anything does at all, like, you know, is it really the case of, like, as the internet, you know, we sort of go through a different process of being siloed. And so what, you know, there is nothing to you, like, there is not, and let me put this another way. Like, I wonder whether as like online becomes bigger and much more fragmented, but also a lot faster, the idea of virality that we have will dissipate, but in its place will not kind of be something that is at least presents the idea of being like this unifying online experience. Like the things that we were dealing with like a decade ago, maybe slightly less, which were like, okay, well, you know, people are interested in different things, but you know, if you've been online in any capacity, you've probably seen the story about Cecil the Lion, or you've seen the story about the dress, or you've seen these types of like things that at least kind of are these sort of universal observations among people who exist in different kind of facets of online. I wonder whether you had any thoughts on like, does the new virality, if it's worth calling it that, is it one that acknowledges that being online means that you can't really have those types of unifying experiences anymore? Or at least like the ones that you do have are going to be ones that are just going to be incredibly filled. Like I think about, for example, all the posts about like Israel and Palestine, where obviously this is kind of a phenomenon that the entire world is experiencing. But I wouldn't necessarily say that we are watching it unfold in the same way that we have watched other conflicts of like the past decade.
No, definitely not. I mean, I would equate it to music or TV, more so than movies, where it's this thing where there's still going to be new viral content. There's still going to be like a new big video that everyone's talking about. And there's still going to be big news stories that everyone's talking about. Like those things are sort of just ingrained in human nature, where those things are going to happen. But we've now created such a deep canon, a deep backlog of previously viral stuff that it doesn't really matter anymore. You know, it's like a new big artist releasing a song. Like you're like, okay, great. Like it's, you know, we're not really like obsessing over how many radio plays a song gets anymore. Same deal with the internet. Mm. I also think individual internet bubbles have become more well-defined. So for instance, I could be like, you know, I'd love to see your goon rig and you would know what I'm talking about. And that is because we inhabit the same internet. And so you already see this with a lot of like the newer Twitter knockoffs where, you know, Blue Sky is essentially just a gated version of a particular pocket of Twitter that existed in 2018. And so, and as is Threads actually, but a different pocket. And so I think that will just become more accepted and more common. I mean, I think it already is. I think that's just the way it already works. And it doesn't mean that we're not going to have no like new Cecil the Lion or something. I mean, Taylor Swift, for instance, has branched all parts of culture at the moment. She is everything. She's everywhere. And so we're going to get that stuff. But I think the specifically Mr. Beastian trick of making virality your sole product, your sole project, is ending. I do think it's possibly already over, because it's just not that interesting to say like, oh, this is the most viral thing now. Like nobody really cares, I don't think.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good way to end this. So Ryan, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for talking to me and explaining to me the Mr. Beast phenomenon. Really, really appreciate it. If people want to follow your stuff or subscribe to your newsletter, how can they do that?
Go to garbageday.email. And then from there, I will pull you down the subscriber funnel so you can engage with my content on all platforms and all services.
Go do that. We'll put the link in the show notes. There's lots of really good stuff on Garbage Day. It definitely helps me out when like thinking about like stuff for this show and just about the internet in general. So yeah, definitely something to check out if you are interested in more online culture and how that works. Thank you so much for subscribing to us. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We really appreciate it and also appreciate your support. You know all the show notes because you subscribe. If you don't, that's kind of a weird thing, but we'll put the links in the show notes anyway. And then one final thing, we would very much appreciate any support for any ability that you have to support the current situation in Gaza. There are links to fundraisers, including medical aid for Palestine. If you can do that, we would really appreciate it. Obviously, the situation in Gaza is horrific, and any type of help is very, very welcome. Yeah, and I think that's it. Other than to say the show is produced by Devon, follow them at Devon_on_earth. Listen to their podcast, not their newsletter. Listen to their podcast, Kill James Bond, if you don't already. That's it. Till next time, we'll catch you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.